Bran looked at the crow on his shoulder, and the crow looked back. It had three eyes, and the third eye was full of a terrible knowledge. Bran looked down. There was nothing below him now but snow and cold death, a frozen wasteland where jagged, blue-white spires of ice waited to embrace him. They flew up at him like spears. He saw the bones of a thousand other dreamers impaled upon their points, and he was desperately afraid. Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast. Originally founded in 2010 as Two Champs and a Chump, we decided to rebrand when the game relaunched in the second edition. A huge thank you goes out to Fantasy Flight Games and George R. R. Martin for this game and world we love, and of course to my co-hosts and you, the listeners. Please, if you enjoy the show, leave us a review on iTunes or your platform of choice. Comment on our Facebook threads, or even better, support us on Patreon. We love turning that kind of support back into the community. This is Season 10 of the White Book Podcast. There we go. I ran out of the exciting stuff a long time ago, so now I'm just poking fun at the fan fiction on television.
I wonder if he saw Euron's bones down there.
Nah, I think that bone was busy buried elsewhere.
Yeah. Oh. Got him.
Welcome back to the White Book, everyone. I'm Will. And as depressed as I am about the weekend, on to more exciting things here with my lovely co-hosts. Joining me, as almost always, is Roy. And the erstwhile Aaron continues his run since his return. And long time no see, Jesse, but welcome back.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Yeah, it's been a while, but I am very glad to be back, and this is going to be a very fun episode.
So what are we doing this episode, Mr. Carpenter?
Glazer made me rank amongst the cards. So we are, from 2 cost to 7 cost, we are putting what, at this current state in the game, what we believe are the best cards in that cost slot. And Glazer made a list, and I made a list. And Roy and Will debate, and we will have a winner at the end.
I'm really worried that Jesse almost forgot my name.
So, I did not. I could never forget your name.
So, just for the record, so before we start, like, my number 5 on the 2 cost slot is going to be Old Billbone. If, as we discussed the 2s,
already wrong.
Fine. Well, but like, if Old Billbone is higher on the list for Jesse, we won't discuss him when I say him. We'll discuss that card, whoever has them higher on the list. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Cool.
I think they should take our whole list in. I think they should take our whole list together.
Oh, sweet.
And they should say, this is like, these are the reasons I think this list is correct. These are the reasons I think this list is correct. I may disagree with this one, but like, Jesse made a better list at 2, 3, 4, 5, and 7. Oh. And Glazer, like, maybe 1-1 or something.
Okay. Yeah. So we'll keep tally of that kind of thing. But, like, as we discuss each individual card, like, we should go one at a time, right? All right, so you want to start with the 2 cost?
We can.
So I have Old Bill Bone at number 5. Is Old Bill Bone on your list?
He is not.
He is not. So Old Bill Bone is on my list specifically because the meta we're in, he does such significant work between Balon and Sea of Blood everywhere and all the various Neil faction card triggers that are so pivotal. We haven't seen Wildlings in a little bit, right? But like Wildlings didn't suddenly disappear. Yeah. Old Bill Bone being a direct answer for these as a neutral that can go in any deck.
They did disappear though.
They'll be back. Like they'll randomly almost take a turn of it.
No, if you're gonna play that faction in America, you're just gonna play Sea of Blood because it's better. It's more efficient. It lasts longer. Like it's just
all
like,
of our
free folk outside of Europe is dead.
All of our listeners are not in America because we know for damn sure exactly one Brit is listening.
But here's the thing. I mean, I agree with Jesse. Like, I mean, it's not even that popular in Europe. Like, free folk. Like, if you enjoy that style of play, there are now better options. If Sea of Blood gets hit again, like gets restricted or something like that, then space for free folk might open up again. But like, why would you not play loyal cards unless you're just a true Wildlings aficionado?
Not play faction.
Like, if you love hard aggro, you just play a hard aggro Sea of Blood, and it's been proven that those decks are successful and more like and have more options.
Either way, old Bill Bone stops both, so
it's pretty efficient. I mean, I agree that old Bill Bone is a very well positioned card right now. And it's definitely something that most decks should be looking at, but
I took it into account what cards are actually played.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but Sea of Blood is a card that's actually played.
I agree. Old Bill Bone should be played. It's just not. My number 5 is Masande.
We don't have. She's my number 4, so we might as well talk about her now.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah.
She's good. I'm surprised she's not a little higher.
The two
drop spots pretty flooded.
Yeah, the 2-cost slot is loaded. I believe that all four of my other cards are vital to win conditions in their decks, and Masande is not vital to a win condition. That is why. She is just super efficient. Every other card in my top 4 is very vital to every win condition of the specific deck.
She's what I think makes her so good is that she's really how Targ survives attrition. Like, you feel like you're ready to set up a March, you're ready to set up a Reset, you're ready to set up a thing, and all of a sudden there's a Masande or a Duke Masande out there, and you're just like, well, see, the thing now is, like, I will almost always beg my brother Masande, which sounds silly, but, like, I will almost always cancel a Masande where possible and let my opponent's board state get screwed up. It is extremely strong and tempo-heavy.
Yeah, I think the thing that people really also don't really bring up is, the way in which Masande props up the Banner Dragon package, because it's 3 free cards or 2 free cards that don't hurt the efficiency of your deck when you're fishing around for a lot of the combo enablers. So I think, you know, like Sandy proved, and of course what happened at Jesse's Name Day, the Tyrell Dragon is very present. It's reason why Banner Dragon is such a powerful part of the cohort package out of Alliance. It's because you now have access to 3 efficient cards. The opportunity cost of putting in your deck is really low, and that is one of the weaknesses of a lot of the banner packages, which is that, you know, there's might be 9 cards that or 7 cards that are useful for what you want to banner for, but finding those other cards is huge opportunity cost. But the fact that Masande is so efficient and non-loyal and in a banner package that's like really appealing right now, and it just seems to be getting more appealing with the release of City of Secrets, but we'll see when the meta plays out there, is a thing that really raises her up.
All right. Jesse, what's your 4?
My 4 is Shadow Tower Basin.
Not on my list. That's our difference.
I would put it higher.
Ooh.
That's weird. So, Builders has busted.
So I'm trying to take the modern meta into account where possible, and while Shadow Tower Mason is a completely phenomenal card, I feel like the meta is doing a solid job at answering both Builders and Shadow in general and Shadow Tower Mason specifically right now. I don't think Wall is playable right now, so that really hurts Shadow Tower Mason.
I mean, literally my Name Day just happened and a ton of Builders
to come. But the meta changed. Right? Like, and it'll okay, so and builders will always
when it happens in a tournament, I'll believe you.
Builders will
when it happens in a tournament, I will believe you.
So if you're playing Greyjoy right now, you should be running at least one Night Flyer, but probably two. And if you're running Night Flyer and you can get it out, get it done twice, the wall is basically screwed. For between that and like mirror, that being like an awesome mirror target, and like what else? Venomous Blade being really heavy in the meta right now, as far as
Venomous Blade has been heavy in the meta forever.
So
you still play Shadow Tower Mason
and Urn, and like with all these different answers, include, and especially with Night Flyer weakening wall otherwise, I think Shadow Tower Mason is in on the same power level as many of these cards. I just think its place in the meta literally shifted with this pack.
I disagree, but we always say this hurts builders, this hurts builders, this hurts builders, until people play it, and then doesn't matter. Builders still prevails. It sucks.
I mean, so I think the three best deck, two of the three best decks in the meta, are very solid builders answers right now.
Which two?
That's my number four, though.
Greyjoy, anything, Stark Sea of Blood.
Okay. The easy location control. Go figure.
So I guess my number three is Mira.
Mira's my number two.
Yeah, I figured.
All right.
Mira's, which means I'm pretty sure I know what your number three would be, but Mira's completely amazing. The only reason she's not higher, well, there's two reasons she's not higher. A, she lost the ability to hit locations, and very often the thing I really, really want to hit with her is a location that she can't. But the real reason she's not higher is occasionally Stark doesn't have the board or the way to use her as consistently as they want. Assuming you do, she's completely busted, one of the like best cards in the game. But if you don't, like if you have to worry about attrition, if the opponent can continually eat at your board, it can be hard to use her consistently. And in those games, like you can really cause Stark problems, right? Like, I think Stark is probably the best right now, but and Mira is a huge reason why. But when they can be forced to struggle, it's because you can force Mira to struggle.
Yeah, I just put Mira at three, or I put Mira at two because she's busted, and I love her.
Fair
my
enough.
Number three is Three Finger Hob.
That's my number two.
Yep, that's fine. Those are interchangeable. I have no arguments there. I just think Mira's better. And the fact, like, you can protect her against burn a little bit more than Three Finger Hob.
Mm-hmm.
Those bad matchups. I think Mira, like, Three Finger Hob, I'm not saying is win more because it's very good, but Mira is a lot more vital to win conditions to me than Three Finger Hob is. So, but I see maybe argument both ways.
Maybe. I just think card advantage, and I think I like that Hob. I don't really need anything else to happen for Hob.
Sure.
I also like that for Mira to be really good, you should already be set up. And for Hob to be really good, he makes you get set up. Like, I very often don't need more than one or two Hob triggers to win a game. Like, I just really, really enjoy how much he helps me get to the point where I can win, even if at that point he's not as good. Especially in a faction that badly wants to see very specific cards.
Which means we don't have to discuss our number one. It is Desert Raider.
Yep, it's Desert Raider, because Desert Raider is super-duper busted.
Yep.
It's definitely a very strong card.
Alright, now deliberation begins.
Alright, go for it, guys.
Why don't you just say your entire list in order now, just to make it easier for the discussion?
Alright, mine is 1, Desert Raider, 2, Mira Reed, 3, Three Finger Hob, 4, Shadow Tower Mason, 5, Masande.
I am Raider, Hob, Mira, Masande, Old Dillbone.
Okay, that did help. I'd been trying to type these out as you guys went. Ooh, that's a lot to keep up with.
Yeah, at the end, we'll make sure we list them for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Good call.
Mm. probably. I think. I mean, they're just so close to each other that it's not like a massive difference. So the fundamental difference is whether or not you have faith in builders the way Jesse does, or you think that an all-around, probably the most efficient answer card as a character that's been printed at neutral by Danny is so which is more important and which is more shaping the meta. I think I'll have to go with Jesse here. I think that it is important because I think Builders is one of those decks that I do agree with Glazer that it is not well positioned right now, but it remains a constant threat, particularly at larger events. And you can just see this with the way in which Mike Lamzik, you know, made another top eight playing Builders. Like, it in the hands of skilled players, it is always going to be present in the meta, particularly if someone comes wanting to make the cut at a large and competitive tournament, because Builders' consistency and power level remains strong. And I think that but that's saying Glazer's in like a place 1.5. Like, the difference between the two lists, I think, isn't really super worth arguing over, but I think that the respect that Jesse showed Builders is a little bit stronger than the respect that Glazer showed Old Bill Bone.
Will?
You know, I think I don't have a whole lot to add to this other than just seconding the thoughts that I think the nod to Builders as an overall you know, kind of consistent force in the meta versus the general utility of Old Bill Bone is it's an interesting consideration. If we're just like flat talking power levels of these cards only, I think I gotta give the nod to Aaron.
Someone has to win.
At that point, we're even. We'll compare them at the end. So we're gonna say split decision.
Yeah, I'm keeping.
We don't have a third.
All right.
I wrote it on my doc. Split decision for two. All right. Okay. So,
and I did not do an honorable mention for the two cost slot. Actually, I did one for every other one, but I did not do one.
If I have to pick one honorable mention, and I won't just pick Shadow Tower Mason because that's the most boring answer possible. My favorite two coster in the game is two cost Arya Stark.
I guess if I had to pick one, it would be Highgarde and Courtier.
It's also a good card.
Yeah, I think Scheming Septon is super duper fantastic too. Yeah.
I was very surprised to not see Scheming Septon on anyone's list. I would have,
if two cost is. I mean, look here, just a quick for people to like. Air Island, Arya, Bren, Greenblood Trader, Dane Escort, Penny, Jorah, Shadow Tower Bastard, Cat's Paw, Scheming Septon, Raider from Pike, which is the actual restricted one.
I just think it has more to do with the place of Tyrell right now in the meta versus the other factions.
Yeah, spoilers. There's not a whole lot of Tyrell on this list for me.
All right.
You want to do your number five for three?
Yep. Starfall Spy.
I
think it is a staple moving forward in Shadows and Kingdom of Shadows decks until the end of time.
Oh, yeah, I didn't.
I think it is unbelievable.
I didn't put it because Kingdom of Shadows isn't out. I was trying to stick with the current meta, so Kingdom of Shadows isn't out, so it didn't make the list.
Literally. I still would put Starfall Spy there.
I love it. It's one of my favorite cards. As you know, I played a lot of Martell Shadows. But until Kingdom of Shadows, I think it's not quite there. I have in my number five spot Arya Stark. I think the
I have her quite a bit higher. Okay. I'll
well,
that.
this yeah. So Arya has been a staple in Stark since the beginning. The automatic dupe basically makes like has been ridiculously huge throughout the history of the game. She is completely amazing. The fact that you can, if like she's canceled or use the dupe, and then you can air her or Skagos her and everything else to get her back, she's busted as hell. What's your number five, Jesse?
You mean my number four?
What was it? Oh, yeah, your number four, sorry.
Drangon's Disciple.
Ooh. Okay, higher for me. Sure. My number four is Alisane.
It's good, but it needs other pieces to work, so. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's literally the whole win condition for that deck, right?
It is definitely not the only win condition for that deck. Someone should play it.
It is. I've played against a lot of Drangon. Is all you assholes play it all the time? Sorry, Will. But I realized what I said right after I said it. But yeah, I played against it a lot. And like, I feel like if they don't see a Drangon Disciple, I can win almost always. Not always. Like, you guys are really good with that stupid deck. But, like, it's that card that gives it its explosive potential and makes it a T1 deck.
I mean, I think it's the fourth best third cost in the game.
Mm-hmm. I think
that's a lot of value giving it.
The second best three cost in the game. I have Alisane at four. Did Alisane make your list?
No, she did not.
Okay, so I think Alisane is a big part of what's driving Stark's power level up right now. Stealth that doesn't kneel is completely ridiculous in Sea of Blood, and it's completely ridiculous in Crossing. And the fact that you can search her out with multiple cards is also phenomenal. She's real hard to get off the board, and she makes Stark both faster and more aggro-y. And that's basically what the faction wants to do. What's your number three?
Arya.
Okay, fair enough. My number three is the Beg Bro.
It's not on my list.
Begging Brother, I think, is my between Begging Brother and Two Cost Arya for my favorite cards in the game. I'm running two or three in literally absolutely every deck right now that has any kind of gold. I think it's the most important card of the game. The game has always been extremely high variance. I find that a Begging Brother with one gold does an awful lot to smooth that out and let player skill matter. Knowing when to use it, using Threat of Activation, messing with it, is just extremely powerful in the hands of a skilled player, and it's one of my favorite cards.
I just couldn't put a card in here that people don't play.
I don't care if people play it. People should play it. If people want to be bad, people want to be bad. Again, like any deck you see me play, just assume I'm running Begging Brother, because spoiler, I am.
Now I'm getting nervous that... my number two didn't make your list. The Hound.
I love the Hound. Yeah, go ahead.
He's still the best Lannister card that's ever been printed.
I think I suddenly disagree, but until very recently, I agree. Hound is my actual fourth honorable mention, because the three cost slot is super stacked.
I think the Hound is still just insanely busted.
I think the Hound is amazing, but I feel like in what Lannister does right now, he's not terribly important.
Right, because the Hound and their two cost gold location is not good.
It's great. It's just I don't think they have a flea bottom build that is one of their better builds. I think their best builds are running trade routes, or they're running something out of faction.
I didn't think I'd have to argue for the Hound.
Yeah, again, I think he's great. It's just I think Lannister's best builds are largely all shadows, and the ones that are like fun and not super great are usually and Shadows wants trade routes, and the ones that aren't are usually...
I think the Hound keeps you alive in a lot of those games.
He can, but
he does.
He hasn't really... we've both been playing the same deck a lot, right?
Every card mm-hmm. here, how many Lannister decks have you ever seen that are not running 3x Hound? And if you have seen one not running 3x Hound...
Sometimes 2x.
I'm running 2 in the deck that you're playing right now, unless you change that. So you have Alta.
I definitely put in a third Hound immediately.
Okay. So I prefer 2. But either way, a lot of your Clansmen decks didn't run 3 Hound, dude.
All my Clansmen decks always run 3 Hound. Really? You have to have 3 Hound. Yeah, he makes the deck survive.
Okay. Fair enough. Right. I just don't think Lannister is good enough to warrant that position. Or he's good enough in Lannister in that position. Although a Lannister card is going to show up on the four coasters. And number one is Fnatic for both of us, obviously. Yep, Fnatic. I think there's a really strong argument that Raider and Crown Guard Fnatic are the two best cards in the game. So, yeah, Crown Guard Fnatic is completely insane. I feel like if you don't know that, I don't know what to do to help you.
Turns out recurrable characters with strong abilities
are good. Even without the if he couldn't come out of your dead pile, I think he'd still probably be number one on this list. His interaction with...
He's significantly weaker without that. Sure. His interaction with
Balon on top of everything else is completely insane. Mm-hmm. All right, Jesse, want to do your 1 through 5?
One, Drowngod Fnatic, the Hound, Arya Stark, Drowngod Disciple, Starfall Spy. My honorable mention is Summer.
Drowngod Fnatic? Dran Gun Disciple, Egan Brother, Alicine, Arya, and my honorable mention is the Dornish Spy.
She doesn't cost three.
She costs zero or four, I'm aware. If she's got a print of three. Like, a lot of the Shadows guys don't cost what they say they cost either. You're getting ranked as if you were. My up-and-comer, by the way, is Gunther, who's freaking phenomenal.
So, if we're talking about the current meta, I find Jesse's argument for the Hound less than persuasive.
Poop.
I still think that... I mean, we're talking, like, historically in the 4 years that this game has existed, the Hound remains one of the best cards ever printed. I mean, it dominated the game for, what, 2 years? Maybe three?
Quite a while.
But right now, Lannister's just... The power level of Lannister's other cards is so low, and the power level of Lyon, I mean, there could be... Now, the meta could be shifting. We literally just had a pack come out, and maybe some kind of Banner Lyon deck is good, like a really tier one presence in the meta. But I'm until I see that, I'm not going to just assume. And I don't think the Hound really belongs where it is. So I will begrudgingly give this to Glazer, because I think that while I don't think Alisane belongs in this list either, she's closer than the Hound right now.
Oh, so, shit.
Like, I really do like both lists, but I think that they both have a really glaring weakness. Glazer's in the form of Alisane, and Jesse's in the form of the Hound, and I just think the Hound is more of a glaring weakness than Alisane. So I'll have to go with Glazer for this round.
Ouch. See,
I know where your loyalties lie.
Roy's over here looking for weaknesses. I'm looking for strengths in these lists. And, you know, on the one hand, Jesse's got something with the Hound. I personally think he's just absurdly versatile, but he just doesn't have the pool to back him up like he used to, really. Now, I know previous cost slot, I said we were kind of looking at these cards by themselves, less about the deck as a whole, which I guess is a knock against the Hound here. And it's a pro for Begging Brother. Like, I love seeing the Begging Brother over there because it had such a like wide ranging effect on the meta and continues to. I mean, it's kind of overshadowed by the
I don't think it has any effect on the meta.
Really?
I don't think people play it. I don't think people play it. When I see a Begging Brother across from me once a tournament, I'm immediately like, fuck. Like, this sucks. This is garbage. But, like, I thought that we would see more after Ward got restricted, and it just didn't.
People are bad.
You just don't see them.
Just, like, that doesn't mean the card's not super great. And, like, hey, spoiler, this podcast should be your, like, impetus to look at your decks and find space for two or three Begging Brother. Three is the right answer, but if you can only pick three.
Depends on the deck.
So if you're not running Stark or Greyjoy, I think you should probably be running Begging Brother.
You shouldn't be playing Begging Brother in Night's Watch either.
Okay. You should, particularly in Builders.
You should not be playing it in Night's Watch defense. You should absolutely be playing it in New Wall.
People don't play New Wall besides me.
So I put it in your deck. Literally, I put three in. What's your vote? Will?
I think I'm still leaning in that direction, so I think I'm gonna give Aaron this one.
Oh, one nothing, screw you. All right.
Yeah.
I voted for you once, Jesse. Four
costs, so. I go first. Just dance around with it.
Well, yeah, I know this is gonna be different because someone thinks Builders are still good.
Well, it's not gonna be as different as you think, but it's fine. My number five is the new Varys.
Oh, yeah, mine is definitely hot.
What's your number five?
The card is super expensive, and outside of Martell, it's garbage.
So you're rating them.
My number five is Sir Mandon Moore.
So that's higher. Yeah, yeah. So I just think Varys is way better than he gets credit for. You didn't put cards that don't see play, but like, I've been playing him a fair amount in multiple decks. I think Tyrell Shadows is really good. Llama's List didn't get hit by like anything, and people just stopped playing it, and it's still posted. And Varus was completely nuts in that. Varus remains really good in any Martell Banner Shadows list because, spoiler, Varus goes really, really well with stupidly well with Desert Raider. And Varus is amazing in any Lannister Shadows build. And as those are the three factions that have Shadows builds, and all three want Varus, I think he's really strong. Plus, not only do you get to kill with that, his stealth and four strength, make him a really solid way to trigger either the shadow event that kills things. Anyone know the name of it? Poison Coin, thank you. I never know the name of cards.
Yeah.
You know me. Wow, this one I should definitely know. And return to hand E card when you win an intrigue by or power by five. Pinch, thank you. He's really good at making sure pinches go off as a surprise. So, like, given, and both of those are Shadows cards, they're in decks that run him. So I think he's a really extremely powerful enabler for those decks.
I feel almost the same about Mandon Moore. Oh. I just think he's very good. I think he might be one of the most underrated cards in the game right now.
He's my number three on this list. I think Mandon Moore is completely amazing. Using my favorite feeling in the game right now is using Mandon Moore two or three times in marshalling, and then watching opponents slowly freak out and be like, oh shit again. And like, he's amazing. He might be too low. He's the new Ramsay Snow.
My number four is Aegon.
Aegon did not make my list. He's like a one of in every target pick, right? He used to be more, but like now he's only a one of, so that kept him down.
It depends on the deck.
Okay.
He's one or two, I
think. Yeah, in some Sea of Bloods, he's a two. I'm short of that, he's usually a one.
He's just like insanely, like, he's just so good. God, he's good. Every time I see a Shadows card with Targ, I just like, I just want it to be a Queen's card. Like, I don't want it to be Aegon.
So, I.
Like, Dario is just stupid.
Like, I run Pegging Brother. So, Aegon is less scary for me. And, like, the two.
I'm saying in the meta, like, people don't play Pegging Brother, so Aegon is nuts. The two best
houses are Stark with.
Aegon also cannot be.
Right. The other two best factions in the game right now are Stark and Greyjoy, and Stark just got a really good Aegon stall card, and Greyjoy has Vince. So, like, I think Aegon is extraordinarily powerful, but I think his place in the meta was greater 6 months ago than it is now.
Maybe.
All right, my number four is.
I don't think my four or three is going to be on your list, so. She's my number one.
She's not my number one, but we'll get there. I just think Kat is amazing. The only reason she's not higher is that there's another character with her name I really like to play. And I do not like doing the two of one, one of the other thing with Kat. The only card I think that's the right decision with is Arya.
They're in different builds, though.
I just think this Kat, and this is both spoiler, both Kats are on my list. But like, I just really, really, really love this Kat.
Yeah, I agree. I think she's the best forecaster that's ever been printed. She shuts down everything still. She's like, in my opinion, she's might be like the best core card ever.
Better still.
She just literally does. She just shuts everything down. Like now with Kohor, she can be insanely versatile. Like outside of Fat Cat, you should all like, she's in every Stark deck from the beginning to the end of time. Stark is like the best faction. Right now, it's between them and Greyjoy. Stark shuts everything down, and Catelyn is a big proponent of that.
My big problem with her, I think, is that I don't run more than one, maybe two of her in what I consider the best Stark deck.
I don't know why that is.
Fair enough. my number three is Mandon, so we already discussed him. What's your number three?
Sir Courtney Penrose.
Oh.
Super great action economy. I think he's really good in every Bera build now. He's very good in Bera Rose Kohor. very good in Bear Rose. I think he will be insane in every build moving forward.
Talking about post-box, right?
Sure. I mean, I think he's very good now. I mean, there shouldn't be a Bear build without, like, three Courtney Penroses.
Three, wow.
He just stands and does another challenge. Like, would you play a challenges-based Lannister deck not playing that many Jamies?
The reason I don't like him as much as you do, my argument against him ultimately, is the reason I run one of his. I, generally speaking, do not want power to be my first challenge. Or my second. Like, I really, really get it.
Sure, but with Barry, I always care.
I like my challenge orders. I like my, like, that kind of little, like, that's it, the way I play. I very specifically largely want power to be my last challenge, unless I'm chumping it. And if I'm chumping it, he's not who I'm using.
I don't know. I like him too. A lot. I think he's very good.
I think he's a very good card. I think the comparison to Jamie is wrong, though, because the strength of Jamie is there's no cost to his not kneeling. I mean, you have to do the intrigue before you do, do the military before you do an intrigue with Jamie. But like,
yeah, Courtney kneels because he is a bear card.
Right. Bear card.
He doesn't get as buffed as his other cards.
The better card, I think, actually, to compare him to is Greyjoy. And I think actually he compare well to what Bear. Yeah, to what Bear
wants. He doesn't have intimidate.
In context of Bear. Like, and the cost slot. Remember, he costs less than Greyjoy. You know, like card.
Sure. I mean, I like Courtney a lot, so I'm going to put him there.
I do think he compares well to the card. They're obviously different because they're in different factions, different parts of the color pie, different cost slots. But I think that's a better way to think about the ability because they're what.
Sure.
That's
my number two is Castle Black Mason.
That's my number
He's
one.
He's good in every Night's Watch deck.
It's his versatility, right? Like the no attachments, the ability to go get whatever you want, including what's the most important card in almost every Night's Watch deck, is unmatched. Six Cogswall, or the attachment you need to stick on somebody to do X, Y, or Z, right? Like the fact that he can get attachments. Yeah, exactly. That's, Lord that's Commander what I was thinking. Yeah. Or Longclaw, right? But like whatever you're.
Or grab a catapult or, with old Donald Noy in play.
Like a bodyguard or a flea bottom or a milk or a Craven or like it's very
Castle Black Mason is just favorite.
He's my number one. I think Knight of Flowers.
What's your number two?
Four Quest Knight of Flowers is busted. Combo Knight of Flowers.
Oh, combo Knight of Flowers?
One of the main engines in the spell field.
Okay. He put Knight of Flowers at 2. I get a pass for putting Courtney at 3 then.
Well, Knight of Flowers is not in a T1 correct. Deck, and Courtney is not. Courtney will be. He is not. Knight of Flowers is the engine of the Tyrell field, like the main character that like stays on the board and gets all your power. He's your like house fort in the Tyrell field. He's how you make sure you can win all the challenges and do all your silly shit. Oh, I very disagree. And he's real, real good in the dragon version too. Like, I just think that Knight of Flowers is great. Like, he changes the way you have to play.
Is he even in the dragon version?
It's in mine.
He's, no.
I'm going to go look at Sandy's version. Give me a but.
Yeah.
And then my number one was Catelyn, so.
All right, so.
My five. Sir Manon Moore, Aegon Targaryen, Courtney Penrose, Castle Black Mason, Catelyn Stark.
All right, so I'm Varys, Cat, Mandan, Knight of Flowers, Castle Black Mason.
Go ahead, Will.
Oh, this one's tough. I do like the love that everybody's showing to Moore, though Aaron, I think, is pushing harder on Mandan, it sounds like. And I, having been playing a lot of Lannister with Mandan lately, I can really get behind that. His ability is what they've been desperately craving for a long time, and trying to chain that multiple times finally actually gets them into some realm of card advantage. I'm not, however, very sold on the Shadows Varys at the moment. He keeps coming up a day late and a dollar short when I've been attempting to use him. Either he can't actually kill something, or I can't quite afford him on top of other things that I'm wanting to do more, like, say, Robert and Mandan. On the other hand, Jesse's list, mostly the same here. Big difference being talked about being Penrose. And I think Penrose kind of has that wider general application than something like the combo Knight of Flowers. And with an eye toward the Bear Box coming up, we already saw, what, in the FFG stream, right? The Bear of Forecast location.
Oh, yeah, that seems pretty good. Lands or something.
Yeah, multiple power
the
challenges.
Thing is to rank it in the current meta.
The box is going to drop, like, it's, virtually no, like, speed, like, right? They said Q2. Like, that officially ends in June, right?
Hey, you can't talk to the judges like, while they're
like,
deliberating.
We should have Stannis and Bob on the list. Like, no, that's silly. Like, we can't. Like, no. Do the meta now.
Hey, I never told you guys you couldn't include Stannis and Bob on your list of top cards. I mean, I wouldn't have used Stannis on that list.
I feel
personally,
like if you're running this way with that card right now, your deck is real bad because you're going to disqualify and lose some games. So, I mean, auto losses seem bad.
That's possible.
Go ahead, continue deliberating. Sorry. That's where I remember me getting disqualified.
I do. I'm not particularly.
Yep.
Roy thinks most of us are shit.
Man, I put him higher.
I do love Castle Black Mason, and the appreciation for Castle Black Mason is good. I think I'm going to go with Jesse here.
Hell yeah.
Simply because, like, I've been going back and forth about which is better, the Tyrell Dragon or the Tyrell Fealty. And Sandy's drunken performance last weekend really hammered home to me that the dragon might end up being better. And I went literally to the deck list here, and there is no Knight of Flowers in this list, which tells me that it may not end up being a centerpiece of when combo shakes out in the meta. And so I do think that Jesse is right that Sir Courtney Penrose is a reason to be driven towards Barra that is going to accelerate. But I think right now Barra might be underappreciated a little bit. So I'm more willing to give Jesse's list the benefit of the doubt compared to Glazer's, I think, here.
Will?
Hell yeah.
But I'm not happy with either list.
Cost is just real weak. Aegon was my honorable mention. My other honorable mention, by the way, is
The presence of Aegon also, yeah. Which is, see, I completely forgot because I was focused on the Knight of Flowers question.
Yeah, my honorable mention was Ranging Malice Party. He's just an amazing meta answer right now.
All right, Will, where's it going?
Oh, sorry. I guess I didn't actually say in the end. My vote was going to Jesse.
Hell yeah. Tied up, baby.
Tied up. Let's do five. What's your... I'll go first for this one. Number five. My five for five is Great John.
That's my four.
I think Stark Crossing is super sick. I think Stark Fealty is real, real good still. I think that Stark Sea of Blood is T1. And Great John is an engine for all three.
Correct. Agreed. That's why I put him at four. My number five is Kotho.
Oh, he's way higher for me. Nope. He's my number two.
Kotho's my number five. He's good in dark decks. He doesn't really do anything once he gets on the board, but he's very good. He's just a super efficient body. It just gets to come into play for free. He lost some strength with
18 restrictions.
Flea Bottom being restricted, but he's still insane. I mean, every target player you ever play until the end of time has Kotho Masande on turn one for some fucking reason. So, I don't know.
That's why Kotho is above Great John for me. Great John's only a three times in some Stark decks, while Kotho is a three time, and to me, every single turn deck runs three Kotho. Kotho is just nuts. Like, because he's basically a five for zero. Like, there's.
I do it more so like I would rather see. I'd rather see Kotho across from me than Greyjoy. I don't want double intimidate.
Game versus mid game, right? Like, or like after reset, or like after reset.
Is no mid game and late game to Stark. They just beat you in three turns.
Yes, it is.
By the time you get to turn four, the game is over.
Every game, Stark mid range is mid range. But Kotho.
I didn't say it's 15 power. I said the game is over.
That's not like you don't play enough control then. But Kotho.
Yes, I do. I play a lot of Stark as well.
Kotho is. Sorry. Kotho's basically a zero for five for five intrigue. And like. I think Greyjoy is better on the board, but drawing Kotho changes the whole tempo of the game entirely. Kotho can swing a game by being drawn at a time. He gets rid of dead dupes. He does a million useful things. He's basically what makes Targ-Sea of Blood. He is completely amazing. His combo with Masande is completely unnecessary. He comes with like 18 other Targ cards, including Marine. He is the reason that Targ-Sea of Blood is a deck. I think if you pull him out of that deck is all right. Is immediately T2. Otherwise, they're just so susceptible to control. It's his jump in, his unexpectedness, his, like, that you have to prep for him that changes so much of the game against him.
How do we get along and be best friends so much when you're so wrong about everything?
He is literally number five on your list and number two on mine. I can't be that wrong. We're differing in rank by, like, three. What's your number four, pain in the ass? Okay, my number four is Ariane.
Definitely not
Ariane Martell remains the engine for the any non-Martell shadows or wards. She's good.
Oh, okay. So what Martell decks are good that are not Martell wards and Martell shadows?
No, you didn't. I know you didn't. But like the Martell fealty is legit NT1. There's still Martell.
Literally, Alejandro told me that deck is garbage, and he's the one that played it.
He's wrong. But that's fine.
We've never seen Martell Fealty do anything in 2 years.
We built it a month ago. It's been played once.
If Alejandro can't win with it, can't be that good, dog.
It's the specific format and a pillage.
I'm saying, like, I haven't seen Ariane being a good build Martell Wolf, and that shit was restricted.
Wolf is a still deck. It's still a deck. Martell Cohort is still a deck. It's a one or two of in Martell Cohort.
It's a one of in Martell Cohorn. It's not needed.
It's real good. It's real good in absolute.
Sure, it's a very good Martell card. It's a very good card, just like Kotho's a very good card.
Turns out getting like, a bunch of it's stuff not needed. Well, Kotho is needed. I don't think Ariane is needed in as many
Martell. I put Kotho on my list. I put Ariane
Martell
on my list.
If we're talking about the future and you're getting credit for that in the last section.
I definitely got credit for it.
Because there's no way in hell that Penrose is better than Knight of Flowers now. Penrose is better than Knight of Flowers in a month or 2 months.
Why don't you just move on to your number three?
Because a Banner Box is coming, right? And Ariane will be completely amazing in that Banner Box meta, where it can jump various things into play, where Ariane can come into play free with Renly to then jump in other things, and the cycling that she enables is going to be completely amazing. If you like action economy, she is arguably some of the best in the game. She's at least one challenge, and because Martell has so many come into play effects, she enables all of them, and she enables all of the, like, Rose or Wolf play effects. Martell Wolf might not be where it was. It definitely is not where it was, but she is still an absolute good. Like, it's good. It's just not, like, the top of the meta anymore. I don't know.
That's what good means.
Top of the meta is good, then there's like six good decks.
Sure.
Okay. Well, then they're all in three factions, so everything else is garbage. But, okay. Ariane is fantastic. All right, my number three. Ready? Or do you want to do your number three?
My number three is Ramsey.
If we're talking about cards that aren't in the meta anymore, how is Arya not there but Ramsay is?
Like, oh, I'm sorry. No. Hang on. I have my honorable mention. I have my honorable mention. I'm sorry. I read the wrong card. Mine is Tyrion Lannister.
So,
if we're talking
about cards that aren't in the meta anymore, and you're talking about like literally the same argument, as good as Tyrion is, he's a one of in my Shadows decks, and he's the first card to be cut when there's not space.
Well, you could be wrong. He's the first card to be cut when there's not space. I don't care. He still just gets four hold a turn. He's very good.
If your Shadows deck is relying on Tyrion, you're in trouble because you don't have enough of a board to consistently protect him against the Sea of Blood meta.
Not saying that. I'm saying you should not be playing a Shadows deck without three of them.
100% disagree. You don't have the board to protect him outside of specific.
Board. I wish I could just get like a guest call-in from Bratz here.
Right? Yeah. Okay, if we could all just play Bratz decks, we'd be in a very different meta, right? But since we don't all just play Bratz decks and we all don't play like Sam Bratz, like remember when he won the Kingslayer and it was like, oh, I'm gonna play his deck, and then like no one could, right?
Also, Lanny Crossing is still insane, and Tyrion is in that deck.
He's a 3-up. And that's every big Lannister is. He is not key to that deck.
Is he a 3-up in every Lannister deck that should exist? Yes.
Really? He's a 3-up in Clansman?
The 7-coster is.
Not that one.
If you could play this card in Clansman, you absolutely would.
He is not a 3-up. He should not be a 3-up in Shadows. He should...
Wrong.
You just can't. You want to reset the board. You want to keep the board small. Getting a dude you want to stick on the board and protect is difficult, which is always the problem with the Cersei, who's better if you're going to... You can only really afford one way to do that, and it's Cersei if you're going to have to. He's a 3-of in... He's a 3-of in Crossing, which is good, but not anywhere near where it was. And he's the single least important expensive character in that deck. And then he's not he's just not important. He's good, but he's not important.
I have an argument. He is.
There good argument.
Go. All right.
My number two is Tarl.
Tarl is my number three. It was a toss up between Tarl or Clotho in the 2-3 spot. I ended up going Clotho because he's in more decks. I like to give a little extra credit where possible to in a lot of decks, and Tarl is in one deck. I just think the one deck Tarl is in is better than any deck Clotho's in.
He's in Greyjoy Sun, Greyjoy Wars, Greyjoy Greensight, Greyjoy Watch.
There's a lot of ways to say one deck. But,
Greyjoy Watch.
Right.
Our number one is Danny.
Let me talk about Tarl. So the reason I don't have Tarl higher, because I really wanted Tarl to be number two, is that Tarl, while he really accelerates and helps that deck, isn't necessary for it. He helps a lot. I've lost to it a lot with that when it doesn't see Tarl or when I can eliminate or otherwise control Tarl. Like, Tarl is important.
If you eliminate one, then they have to play another. If you eliminate him, they have to play an Aeron or an Old Grey Goal. Like, but he is vital to the deck. He gets around, like, if this deck ever goes, like, the best deck in the game, and people start playing Barring the Gates, Tarl allows you to get around it, still have a win position.
That's an awful lot of games that don't really exist. Right now...
No, it is. It's one of the best decks in the game, and Tarl's there.
Tarl is there.
Tarl is better than Clotho. Tarl is
not better than Clotho, because...
Yes.
Let me finish. While Tarl is really good, Ground God has a million tools to do the same thing that Tarl does. Tarl is the easiest one, but not the only one. I've managed to stick a milk on Tarl for an entire game and still lost to that deck.
Oh, thank God.
Tarl is great. He's just controllable. And Danny is number one.
Sure, Koto's controllable too. I just played Dragon God Fanatic. Has, sucks.
I believe three cards in the entire game. Entire card pool that control him.
One of them is a 3-of in every Greyjoy deck until the end of time.
Absolutely. One of them is a 3-of in every Greyjoy deck until the end of time. And the one is in a faction that sees very little play, and one you claim doesn't see any play. Your honorable mention was Ramsay. Ramsay is my favorite. But my honorable mention was Justin Massey.
My list is Dany, Tarl, Tyrion, Greyjoy, Kotho.
Dany, Kotho, Tarl, Arianne, Greyjoy.
Jesse.
Yes.
I think mine's Jesse. I think that I think Jesse's balance of where the five cost slot should be is a little bit better than Glazer's, even though he put Tyrion on his list.
Yeah.
Even though Tyrion, what are you talking about? Tyrion is one of the ones I was looking for. Man, if one of you guys had Arianne and Tyrion, slam dunk.
So I forgot Tarl existed. True story. Tyrion was my number five, and I forgot Tarl existed. That's why I asked you what his name was right before the call.
You literally roasted me on Tyrion for 10 minutes. Look, and he was on your list.
I think he's the sixth best.
That sounds
five.
Like Aaron.
Coster. I just don't think he's better than anyone else on the list. I definitely don't think he's better than Arianne.
I definitely think both of those are poor choices right now. But I think that Jesse's understanding that, like, Drown God is one of the best decks in the most recent meta. Whether or not it survives into the City of Secrets is an open question. But I think that it's dominated the winter in a way that was just really clear with Sean's grind of a victory at Jesse's name day and the way he just tore through the true Swiss part in the cut. Including winning matchups that people said going in that he shouldn't have been able to win. And I do think if you delete Tarl from that deck, the deck is just not good. It can still do the things that it needs breaks open. And
my argument wasn't...
You said it doesn't need it to win. I think the deck does need him to win.
It doesn't need it to win a game, not a tournament. Like, you wouldn't run the deck without it, but, like, you can...
Yeah, I mean, like, Builders doesn't need the wall to win a game.
Sure.
Like, I've seen Chase.
Sure.
I've seen
like,
Chase
that
win
is not
games.
Like, Drown God
Tarl and the four cost wall in their decks in Builders and in Drown God are exactly the same card. Like, they are the fundamental reason
Drown
to
God
play
Disciple
it.
Drown God Disciple is significantly. Tarl without Drown God Disciple just doesn't. Do too much that I give a shit about.
I mean, I'm not sure I call Tarl equivalent to the wall as far as being like the fundamental reason to play that deck. I mean, at that point, like you're just replaying some characters. It's not like a win piece on its own, like the way the wall is in my mind.
Disciple is just more important.
But the Disciple existed before Tarl. Like, you forget, like, Aaron used to laugh off Drown God when Jesse and I would talk about it. I wanted to play Drown God for so long, it was waiting for a card.
It's the card that puts it over the top, but it also, spoiler, got like 8 more cards in the last few months. It's not like it got one.
I mean, I agree.
You know what else it got? It got the stupid thing that lets it draw a million cards.
Well, make a decision.
I said Jesse, you're not. So.
I think my decision in the end also still goes to Jesse.
Right. Woo! Took the first lead of the game,
let's
boys.
Do six.
My number five is
my number
Randall
five
Tarly.
Is the host of the Boneway.
Yeah, definitely not on my list.
Oh my god, the bias.
You've yelled at me that card is broken so many fucking times. No, Jesse.
Me?
Sure. Sure, I think all these cards in here are broken too.
Go ahead.
A lot of broken cards up in here. I don't have to argue for Randall. Everyone knows what he does. He's stupid. And like Randall just like in the last year, Randall's seen the biggest resurgence, I think, of any card ever.
Because he was like, not very good when Breaking Ties was everywhere.
Correct. No one could play him. And then Breaking Ties got restricted. And then we got Highgarden Courtier. And then we got the 2-drop location that just says Stan Randall.
Randall would be on my list if he was in a deck that I thought was like close to T1 right now. He just isn't.
So let's go back. Hold on. I still got the deck list open. What is in Sandy's combo deck?
I bet there's 3 Randalls.
I don't think there's 3. Just let me double check. There are There are two.
I also just still don't love that deck, but that's fine. Okay. It's very good. It's just, I don't think Randall is that good. I think Host of the Boneway is in the best Martell deck. I think it is the single most important character in that deck by far. And a host...
probably I don't run area around sure.
in that deck. Host of the Boneway.
I think that's what
it's probably that very specific deck that runs literally no jumpers except Hota. Yes, that is correct. In a completely non-jumper deck, it does not go. Great. Host of the Boneway, however... literally runs the board. Like, if I get a Host of the Boneway, I can control what my opponent can do, when they can do, and how they can do it. If they have control, the control is immediately to Host of the Boneway, and it's but not
outside
unique.
Of Martell Wharf, sure. That card is pretty trash,
maybe,
right?
I don't know. I've never actually haven't talked about it. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm just asking.
Outside of Drowned God, Tarl is kind of trash. Okay. So, like, yeah,
you don't know that.
So he is yes, Host of the Boneway in his Host of the Boneway.
That one's already been decided.
Host of the Boneway in his one absolutely T1 deck. Absolutely T1 deck. The single best Martell deck is the single most important character.
Shit. Randall's been in T1 deck since before sure, Host of the Boneway was like, even thought
talking,
of.
But we're not talking about the meta 6 years ago. This isn't a lifetime achievement award. This is for the meta.
It might be. You don't know.
No, that's literally the whole point. Like, our discussion was for the meta right now. What are your top picks there?
Randall's good in every Tyrell deck.
And Host of the Boneway makes the best. And Host of the Boneway makes the best Martell deck work. The single best and most important Martell deck work. And also, spoiler, he's going to be real good since we can look back. I guess we can also look forward. He's going to be real, real, real good. In Martell Stag. Oh, he definitely is.
Yeah, I doubt it. But four cost is Drogon. My fourth is Drogon.
Number two. I have Euron at number four.
I don't have Euron on my list.
Okay.
Wow.
I mean, okay.
I just forgot.
So,
Euron would have been my number five.
So, sure, Euron's completely amazing, right? Like the entire.
Yeah, he is good. I would have put him at number five based on my list.
I think Euron is straight up busted.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's very good. I just think every other card on my list.
So, what's your number four? Oh, we did that. Yeah.
Drogon. Yeah, I think Drogon is insane, and like he should be pushed higher maybe in most matchups, but like Drogon can't easily be shut down. Like against Stark, Drogon shut down, which is very good right now. Against Martell, he shut down because of icon control. Like he can just be shut down very quickly. But when he goes off, he's insane. But he's just not as versatile as my other top three cards.
So as a Martell player, I have Drogon at number two. I have to control for Drogon at all times.
Sure.
So like that means I have to like mulligan for Starfall. I have to play my game very specifically for that because like while he can be controlled, there's not as much direct control for a no attachments character as you would think.
I agree with
you.
I'm just saying he's more easily controlled than the other three on my list. I didn't say he was easily controlled.
Right. He is reasonably. Easily controlled. He's also like, I think that undervalues his ceiling. Drogon on turn one is, I think, the one of the two cards on this list that can straight up just blow out a game. Like you see Drogon, so you just win then in there.
Yeah,
and that is amazingly important and potent. And while he is controllable, the fact that like he's so hard to get off the board and keep off the board means that like your opponent largely, because Target's such a pain in the ass, has to dedicate.
I literally just yelled at CT for an hour today about how I do not think Drogon should be in the cube list. I don't think he should ever be in a limited format ever.
He shouldn't. But like, so the thing about Drogon,
you gotta get those chase rares.
Can you imagine someone dropping Drogon on you in a draft turn one? Wouldn't you just be like, I lose. I didn't draft the Valor. I lose.
That happens in real games. Like the condition. Can I spoil a thing? No, I'm not going to. David will kill me. But like Drogon, like, is often a Valor condition. Drogon is the, like, you will dedicate resources and control and time to controlling him.
I just think these other cards win games.
Well, let's hear what the other cards are, Glazer.
My number three is Robb Stark.
So, I want to talk about that, Robb, because he is not on my list. My number three is Wyman. Robb is not on my list because he's
Wyman's
not
on my list, but he's not at three.
He's not in the best Stark deck. And I'll tell you why Wyman isn't in higher. Wyman is also not higher because he's not super important in the best Stark deck. He's great. He's amazing. But he's not in the best.
I think Stark Reigns is just as good as Stark Sea of Blood. So
I know you do, but no one else on Earth gets that result. But the, plenty of people did. We just had like
At my name day, where we picked it up literally 3 or 4 days before, and we went 6-1, 6-1, 5-2.
We just had a million tournaments where it cut and didn't win, or underperformed. And like you guys can't like.
There was a period where I entered four straight tournaments with the deck, and I won four straight tournaments. Yeah,
when it was unknown, and now it's a known quantity, and it's
We took it to Worlds.
It's not a team. Yeah, that's a very different version.
Fat Cat is a known thing since Fat Cat has existed.
That's a very different version. So, like, our Worlds deck was not refined.
Yeah, it was a piece of shit.
Yeah, we got too excited about the idea. Whatever. Neither here nor there. Wyman is amazing. The best Stark deck is running a different Rob and is not reliant on that Wyman. Wyman is number three because he is that amazing.
Wyman is number two on my list.
Yeah, I could see that. Why I could in Stark Crossing,
I don't have an argument for it. I've played pretty much nothing but Stark in the last 5 months, and there's no card I ever want to see more than Wyman.
He's
just insane.
I've been playing.
I don't know why he has the things he has on his card. I don't understand it. It's not fair.
So I am currently assigned to playing Stark.
And if I have Wyman and Robb on the board, it's just over.
Sure, in a lot of decks, but I think the very best Stark deck just straight up doesn't run that Robb. I think King Robb is better in the best Stark deck.
King Robb is better for a year.
How are you? Why don't you just immediately concede? Glazer finally said what you wanted him to say for like a year.
I mean, I want him to say that. I'm happy.
He's better. The reason that King Robb is better,
King Robb's a seven coster. We're talking about six costers.
Yeah. But like, you can only run one, so I think it's relevant, right? Like,
you can't just run as many as you want, up to three.
Uh huh. You're not doing that. No one's doing that. That's a bad idea. But King Plot is this amazing thing, and like King Plot was always busted, and right now King Plot is unreal good because Greyjoy stopped playing its king and almost every Stark deck stopped playing its
king. What deck just shuts down King Plot?
I'm curious.
Sorry,
my wife is yelling at me, so I'm only half listening.
What deck plays three of this Robb and three of this Wyman and just shuts down King Plot? Does anyone have any idea? Oh, Stark Reigns. Weird.
If you say so.
I do an injury challenge of 15. You can't defend it. Okay.
No, I just Winterfell.
If you're playing Stark.
Yeah, we're literally talking about in a Stark deck right now, dude. Like, I'm talking about playing King Plot in a Stark deck right now. That's literally the words I'm saying.
Sure.
Like.
Alright, well, Robb Stark is my three, Wyman is my two, and Drogo is my one.
So, Drogo is number one. That's not really an argument. I have Drogon above Wyman because I think he's more important for what Targ wants to do right now than Wyman is for what Stark wants to do right now.
Disagree.
I mean, so Stark has other sack options.
Sure.
And they have other draw options. He's the best of those.
I agree with you, but I remember Stark without Wyman, and it's garbage.
Yeah, like, you can pull Stark, Wyman out of Stark. And
Targ without Drogon is completely fine. Targ does not need Drogon. Drogon is super win more. Wyman is not win more in any way.
Hey, Roy, what won your tournament last week?
It wasn't my tournament, but Stark Sea of Blood.
Oh, sorry, Vax tournament. How many Wyman was in that Stark deck?
Zero.
Oh, okay. So it looks like Wyman is actually optional in Stark right now, too.
I disagree.
So I'm not saying Stark is bad. Stark versus Drogon can Wyman versus Drogon can easily go either way. I think more importantly, I think Rob is my number six. But I also think Rob is the wrong call. I think Host of the Boneway, Euron, and Wyman are better than Rob.
My honorable mention is Jaime, because I have to put a Lannister card on the list.
Then you should have put Sir Robert Strong.
No, I'm fine with my choice.
Could you guys go over them again? Just say them all in.
My one, Khal Drogo, Wyman, Robb Stark, Drogon, Randall. But my five would be Euron, but I just forgot about him.
Drogo, Drogon, Wyman, Euron, Host of the Boneway.
So I want to come into just a couple of the arguments here. I do think Glazer has a point about Derek's Sea of Blood list and Stark's Sea of Blood being acceptable without Wyman. But I debated, and you were there with Derek, about whether or not it was a mistake to run Flea Bottom as his restricted over Wyman. Because Wyman would give that deck more reach, particularly against slower, controllier, grindier decks, as we saw in the stream game of him losing to Matt Schwarzenbach, where he just didn't get a card advantage engine and he needed one. And so that spoiler, deck doesn't
He could have won the tournament better, I guess. But he won the tournament, so like...
Hey. Right. Whoa. But I mean, he won the tournament, Glazer, but like... We all know, and Derek is easily a goat, right? He's amazing. Mm-hmm. But like in cuts, it's all about, you know, Matt lost. This person loses earlier in the cut. If they don't lose earlier in the cut, you face them, you lose the tournament, right? Like, I'm talking about a matchup. We saw a weakness that Derek admitted to about the deck, right? Like it can't grind as well, and Wyman would offer more options, right? And I think the same argument can be made that there. I think it is the right call to play King Rob in Stark Sea of Blood, but it is an acceptable decision to play Rob, the core Rob. Like core Rob is busted. He's a busted card. He's been
not in Sea of Blood. That's
like the action economy is. I'm trying really hard not to curse. Will the action economy is really, 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 really strong.
He's amazing, just he's not the right call in that one specific deck.
Hey, I'll tell you what, I don't yell at the judges when they're making the decision. That's all I'm saying.
And I think that I agree with you. If I was registering to see a blood list, I would register King Rob. But if I see someone playing Core Rob, I wouldn't think, oh, this person has no clue what they're doing. I would think, oh, that's, I think, a slightly suboptimal choice, but it's an acceptable one. It's something of a debate that you could have, and it's a useful debate because it makes you think about the axes the deck needs to operate under. And I think that Core Rob is a reason to be pushed into Stark. I don't necessarily agree with you that Stark Sea of Blood is the best Stark deck, and I don't even 100% agree with Jesse that Fat Cat is the best Stark deck.
So what do you think?
I think No Fun might be. I think all three of those decks are busted AF. And
I think Crossing has been testing better than No Fun.
Okay, and I mean, there we go. There's a whole other one, and that one runs Core.
Yeah, and Puppies.
Whoa. Jesse. Remember how it said, don't yell at the judges. Don't, like, make the judges question your sanity. All right, but there's at least four decks that are fighting for oxygen in the Stark card pool to be the best Stark deck. And I think three of those four play Core Rob, and Core Rob deserves way more respect than your list gives him. I think Wyman deserves way more respect than your list gives him.
Way more. It's a difference of one spot.
One spot out of five. It's like 20% respect, dog.
And then the question is, I'm just going to go with Jesse. I don't want to debate about Euron. It's and that card. So, I'm going to go with Jesse here.
I think this is interesting from kind of a philosophical perspective, right? So something that kind of underpins second edition is kind of the effectiveness of the kind of age-old question, if you will, in card games, right, is are you the person presenting the question or presenting the answer, right? And First Ed was a very answer-based game. Second Ed is very question-based, right? You're presenting the problem your opponent has to figure out a way to deal with. And as an offshoot of that, we frequently debate on the show and elsewhere about like how kind of abusive the level of stand available in the game is. So I find it very interesting that Jesse's list is in many ways effectively all question or problem cards, while Aaron's kind of splits the difference. I would probably file host and Euron's intimidate into the answer category instead.
Drogon, right?
Well, you can't not have Drogon.
I think Drogon can be both, but I think he is more a question that your opponent has to answer. Like, he will just run away with a game by himself. Yes, he can stop what your opponent's doing the way a Euron or a host can, but he also, by himself, plays up that attacking offensive angle much harder, I think, than at least either of those do. So I think, overall, I'm going to give the nod to Jesse on this one.
Is that just seal the deal, boys? Anyway. Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, we can't.
I think seven's our only different number
on just
one.
Where we place people.
Well,
our one
is
probably for sure different. Mine is definitely not. Mine is King Rob.
Are you high? All right, so like, can we immediately go back and validate?
Yeah,
it's six?
Almost certainly.
Kind of.
Like, can we go back and give me six down because he just stepped his own?
The lists don't matter. They're not connected. Wait, no, I don't have him as one. I have him as three. I don't know why I said that.
He's not on my list. Sorry. He's my honorable mention.
Rip.
So what's your five?
Oh, he's definitely on my list. My five is...
She's my number two.
Asha.
My number five is Renly.
Oh, Glazer won. Okay.
Renly. He loved Renly.
Why does Glazer win?
Do you have Renly on yours?
Yes, I do.
Okay, never mind.
I think Renly is completely amazing. Draw is good. Renown is good. He does everything you want to do. He's amazing.
Correct. Busted. He's a good boy.
All right. So is mine. My number four is Catelyn. She's good in one deck.
Your number three is?
She's Bay. Forever. I love her, but.
Yeah,
my number three is King Rob.
Which Balon?
Oh, that's my number one.
Two seven-cost Balons, right?
Yeah, but like...
Yeah, but we're not talking about heavy metal Balon. We're talking about the one that actually does things.
I want the shitty art one. Sorry, Will.
The only problem I have with that Balon is there's some decks where the faction deal contrast is annoying. Like, I just think he's completely amazing.
I think that any Greyjoy deck not playing this Balon is wrong.
You're missing what you said was the best Greyjoy deck, which can't run this Balon.
Yes, the best Greyjoy deck should play this Balon.
Oh, what?
Should play this Balon.
Why? I
think it should play this Balon.
Very, very, very heartily disagree, and I feel like the reasons are self-explanatory.
That's fine. I would never play a Greyjoy deck with a Balon in it.
The entire
doesn't
point
play this
of your
Balon.
Agenda is a faction deal. The entire point of your agenda is a faction deal.
Yeah.
And so is this Balon.
Yeah.
Cool.
I forgot.
So that's why this Balon is three and not one. If he wasn't a faction deal. Okay. So if that's the best Greyjoy deck, and I think it's the second best Greyjoy deck, not the best, and he is definitely in the best, except that one of her friends just won a tournament with not that Balon in their crossing list, which, again, I disagree with, but like he won the tournament, so like. I'm not arguing with, like, you could win more.
That's fine. I disagree with it as well.
I think this
Balon
is the third best at the highest power cost slot in the game. I just think the faction deal in a sea of, in when you would like to play Sea of Blood is suboptimal, and either of the other Balons are better in that specific deck. My number two is Renly. Asha. I think Greyjoy needs that card search real, real bad. The fact that you don't have to show it to your opponent, the sheer power of the different things you can get, that you can get Vince when the time calls for it, that you can get saves when the time calls for it, that you can get dupes when the time calls for it, that you could go get a cancel, that you can go get a pinch, that you can go, like, the sheer amount of stuff you can get with Asha is completely insane, and it boggles my mind that she's not on your list. Oh, no, she is. She was number five. Yeah, I just think
she's five.
Is utterly amazing. I think she is... And yeah, my number one is Big Vic. Big Vic is the only one of the three Greyjoy 7s that made the list. Yeah, he's the only one of the three Greyjoy 7s that I'd want in basically every Greyjoy deck that's not really competing with another... in every, like, non-Ground Gun Greyjoy deck.
My honorable mention is Cersei.
My honorable mention was Rob. But Big Vic shuts down major decks or demands an immediate answer for major decks. He is ridiculous in Crossing. He's ridiculous in Sea of Blood. He's ridiculous in basically everything Greyjoy wants to do. He's control. He's speed. He's the most burn resistant natural guy they have. He's amazing. Like, he turns the he's the single best card they can have in the Targ matchup outside of Vince.
Sure.
Oh, also real, real good at beating Stark Sea of Blood because he can make their Winterfell not a thing.
Sure, that makes sense.
All right, go for it.
Yep.
You lost the seventh?
I lost. Yeah, I mean, I actively just don't care about seven costers. I didn't. I put very little thought into that one.
All right, Glazer right, wins
so
that
you
one.
You win 3-2 with
who wins
one
overall?
Tie.
There we go. Ooh, oh, I was counting individual votes.
Oh, so I won way more.
I mean, Jesse still
wins. I was
just
counting rounds.
Yeah,
I
just didn't realize Aaron was just counting rounds. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it comes out the same way.
You guys were wrong. Doesn't really bug me.
Clearly.
Yeah. Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah,
well, that's good to know. Yeah, I think that was a different little take on things.
All right.
All right. Will, what does that bring us to?
Ooh, that definitely brings us to props and or slops. Whew. Great big weekend for that, huh?
Yep, who wants to props end game? Someone can do
it. I'll do
it.
End game is great.
Yep.
I will prop it. It basically stuck the ending. You can kibitz over certain elements of it about whether you think certain characters' endings were perfect or not, but it was just an overall amazing conclusion to the first 10 years of the Marvel Cinematic Universe and a celebration of everything you more or less enjoyed about those movies. It made me cry. It was a fantastic movie.
Yeah, it really was good. It was pretty amazing love letter to the MCU and comic books at large too. Like there were a lot of really sweet comic book nods, not just past MCU nods, though. Gosh, I'm wary even on the podcast here that won't come out till the 10th of giving out any spoilers. But I will say, at least, that I am afraid that Endgame shatters the it's all connected illusion. I'm afraid that the TV shows are going to be pretty screwed by Endgame. And honestly, I'm kind of afraid future movies are going to lose track as well.
Wait, plural? What TV shows? Isn't Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. the only TV show that still runs?
Are you talking about the future, the Disney Plus ones?
No. There's also... No. Yeah, the Disney Plus ones specifically. But that's why I said the illusion of it's all connected. S.H.I.E.L.D., so really Cloak and Dagger is still running, as is Runaways. And today they also just announced two new Hulu shows, a S.H.I.E.L.D. spinoff with Ghost Rider and a Hellstrom show.
It is nominally set in the same universe.
The same universe as
even more loosely connected than Cloak and Dagger and anything.
Okay, yeah, I don't think that super matters to me. But
That's why I said the illusion, it's all connected. I mean, most of these shows are mainly disconnected in that they drop a couple names and then just try not to like wildly contradict each other, but I'm afraid Endgame just throws that out the window.
It doesn't. Just think about how comics work, man. Like, occasionally just ends and 80% of the books don't like bother to talk about it. Like, oh shit, existence got wiped out. We rebuilt it last weekend. All the other books, like, shrug.
Okay, I don't think there's any way to avoid it now.
Hold on, Will. There's a way to avoid this.
The problem is
a fundamental way. I don't think it's a huge spoiler to say that Endgame fundamentally changes several aspects of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And where I disagree with Glazer is that I think the amount of change that the Endgame provided. Compare it to like Final Crisis or Christ, like those kind of things. You would it's an opportunity to, I guess, like if DC did that, they would reissue all their books in number one with new status quos, right?
Okay, but in the mainstream Marvel universe, this past year, America was literally run by Hydra with Captain America in charge. It did.
You mean in the Marvel comics?
Yeah, and then like it literally ended, and everything just went back
sort of
to normal.
They rebooted all like half the line, like, if not more.
They rebooted it, but they didn't. They literally just said number one, like rebooting by just saying number one, rebooting by like saying this is a new character. No, it was like never touched on. Like it was just like, okay, we're done with this. Everyone's going back to normal. He's a hero now. And like, there's no like lasting damage or anything to take care of. Like you would think like Nazis ran America would be the kind of thing for like 6 months would be the thing.
That's fair. That's fair.
I think it's different if it's 6 months versus if Nazis had run the U.S. for 5 years. It would be a lot harder for books to completely ignore that, or they have to skip forward that same amount.
If Nazis run America for 3 weeks, that would be all anyone would ever talk about. And also, like, there was, like, they do this literally all the time in the comics. They're just, like, 6 months later, and all the other books stay in the same time, and, like, when they meet up again, like, it's none of that matters. You just hand wave it away.
So I think that it's not a huge deal necessarily that the Marvel universe in the movies or in the shows won't necessarily do it. But I think the biggest problem here is, and I mean this, I say this with great love, Will, ever believing that at least since that Thor episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., that any of the Marvel TV shows have ever really been tied to the movies. And even like the illusion is like,
I deliberately said illusion.
It's like, I think that's even that word is doing too much work there. So,
hey, season one had many connections, not just the Thor episode with Sif in it, which actually I think Sif was in two episodes, if I remember right. But they also had Maria Hill pop up
a few episodes. Yeah,
right. Nick Fury. Yeah. Yeah, and the whole Winter
Jarvis
Soldier crossover kind of arc tied in directly and had Sitwell go back and forth. Right. I was awfully excited to see one of the TV characters turn up in the movie. So it's kind of weird. On the one hand, the movies reinforce the whole it's all connected thing, and then also I think cause some real problems. But I can't do a great job of explaining that without really dropping spoilers. So,
okay, let's just move on.
Jesse, you want to slot the TV show?
Yeah.
Yep, I do. I want to slot the television show for reasons of. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm saying that I loved it for a long time.
I'll say it's bad.
I'm saying that I when you love something for 8 years, I'm not even going to try tie the connection to the books, which breaks my heart 100 times more. When you love something for 8 years and you think something should go one way and it doesn't, and like everyone's character arcs is pointing for it to go the way you want it to, and it doesn't, it subverts expectations to the point where it's not a fantasy story anymore. It's just The Sopranos with dragons. Really just destroys me.
I literally did.
I don't care. Like, you got your way. Like, I'm happy for people who enjoyed it. I'm happy for them. I am not. Like, I don't care what happens anymore. It doesn't matter to me who sits the Iron Throne. It means nothing to me. I do not care in any way whatsoever. And I it's hard for me to have loved something so much and for that to change over the course of 80 minutes. Like, I have no care in the world. I'm sure they will just ruin John's character. And like, that's just not, like, I'm tearing up just talking about it. Like, it sucks. It just sucks. But I'm glad people who like the TV show, who wanted the political intrigue, got what they wanted, because that's.
But it's not even outside the context of the books, it's not like consistent with good storytelling within the context of just the TV show. It's just they're phoning it in. They're phoning it in. It's obvious they are ready to be done. In fact, I'm sitting here right now staring at a headline that is quoting them as planning to be, quote, very drunk and far from the internet, end quote, when the series finale ends.
I mean, that just seems like best practice, being very drunk and
far from the internet. Yeah, probably so.
I'm going to actually prop it. I thought it was completely fine. I thought most of the last two seasons were actively bad television. I also didn't like most of the last two books. I think that as the TV show world was built, it was never built around the magic. It was never built around the idea of this. This was a threat.
Show started.
Sure, it's how it started, but like, correct. A scene here and there is not how.
Literally, how they built up their most important character the whole time, or even if you want to say Danny, it's the most. It's literally built both up around magic.
So not a big deal. So Danny. You can.
It's pretty awesome. John gets. Arya found out about this like 2 days ago.
One very, very specific piece of magic involved in him until the very end. He is largely on the wall. He's doing multiple things. Like, there's the whole wildling question forever. Like, it's gone through multiple narrative arcs. You might not like it. You might have preferred that the magic be the ultimate final threat, which is all perfectly fine. But that doesn't mean it doesn't make sense as a narrative direction. The Arya decision is definitely a strange one. That one makes the least sense. But like, if you had switched that for literally someone else doing the exact same thing, like, we end up narratively in largely the same place without a couple prophecies. And, like, fine, I guess. Like, I'm glad you guys were really invested in ice zombies that had no personality or motivation.
I was.
Glazer. You did so well for so long in your speech. And then you had to go, the classic Glazer movie, you had to go for the, like, twist the knife. I was like, all right, I'm following Glazer's point. But, it's well articulated. And then you had to go,
you had to go for it. But the character, the show gained a following largely through a bunch of people and their decisions set against a bunch of other people and their decisions. And people and their decisions was not really a part of this storyline, and therefore was not a part of the final climax of the show.
I'm going to attempt to, what's best way to put this. I think that there's a lot of truth to what Glazer is saying, and I think there's a lot of truth to Jesse's point of view, and I do not think there's a straightforward answer to how this is being received. And I think it doesn't clearly entirely break down between book people like Jesse and myself to a lesser extent don't like it, and show people love it. It's clearly among people that just mostly enjoy the show, it's divisive for some people for terrible reasons and some people for good reasons. And I think that this episode couldn't answer everyone's emotional needs, whether you believe Glazer and the narrative logic was always leading to a confrontation with Cersei in the end, or you're following the narrative logic of Jesse and I, which is, yes, there are human choices involved. It's a human choice of how you respond to a threat to human civilization that goes beyond just petty human squabbling or political squabbling. Like, whether you think that this is going to be divisive, it's a very divisive decision that they made. I didn't like the episode very much. It's pushed the characters in directions that I'm not particularly interested in seeing. I'll see how the show ends. I'm a spoiler addict. I want to know the ending. I want to see who's going to be on the Iron Throne. Am I less invested? Sure. But I think, and I don't particularly like it. How am I put this? I think in the context of the episode, Arya doing it makes sense. And I have zero problem with Arya being the one that did it.
I mean, correct. This episode only. Sure. I mean, the rest of their own work.
And I do think that Glazer, in his usual Glazer way, is short shrifting the amount of narrative weight they put on this plot. I think that it is true that they have always been extremely interested in the Game of Thrones, the show's name Game of Thrones, the Game of Thrones aspect of it more than the stuff about the Night King and the struggle to prevent the Long Night. But they also clearly were invested in this, not just that they replicated the books, the book's beginning, but also Hardhome, which is one of the most popular episodes and one of the most expensive episodes they produced, besides the one that we watched last night, was all about this plot. But I personally believe they wrote themselves a little into a corner with some of the narrative choices that they made, and this is what they felt was the best solution. It might be from where they ended up in the story that they were telling, but was it the most satisfying for me? No.
So I'm going to go over the logic of this just quickly, because I say narrative structure a lot, and I don't think so the central mystery of the show has been about Jon's parentage, about what that means. And there's two ways you can go with that. You can go the way that once he learns, that's what makes him the great conquering hero, and then he vanquishes the ultimate villain. But if you're not trying to tell that, right, if you're not trying to tell that story, and I never thought they were trying to tell that story, I think very explicitly, almost from the start, or at least from the moment Ned's head got cut off, they were explicitly trying to say, this isn't the story you want to tell. I know, but that wasn't the intended story, because whether you agree or not, it wasn't, right? So that wasn't the intended story. The intended story wasn't John as the conquering hero. The intended story is, what are the repercussions of this love, this war, that he's got this name as a human being, and how does everyone else relate to it and interact with it? And that could have been a matter of prophecy, but the show has ultimately been about human decisions and not the choices your birth forces upon you, not just what your birth means, not about your fate or destiny, but about the choices of your family and your family name and how that affects how people see you and what you do, and the narrative weight of family and decisions. And if that's going to matter, it has to matter as a character choice, because Jon isn't less or more whether he's a bastard or a Targaryen. Whereas if he's the one who kills the Night King and the chosen hero, it's because he's a Targaryen. That crosses out too much of his character arc, where it's not, where his entire purpose is that it's not about that name.
I don't agree. I agree with so much of what you're saying, but I also don't agree, because I think that I think, yes, you and I are agreeing. Like, yes, the show is about these human choices. But the question is, like, which context are these human choices being made is the most important and the most interesting? Is it the story of the conflict versus Cersei, Euron, the Iron Throne? Or is it conflict of this this apocalyptic threat that calls for the best in humanity? And many people just don't answer it well, from Ramsay to Cersei to all these other people, or and people like Jon, Dany, Tyrion. Like, they make the right decisions.
Yes. I very much, like, that is the most Roy outlook possible, right? Like, that you like seeing the best in things and people, and like looking for people to try and do and be their best. And like, while that is both interesting and admirable, the show has largely not, the show or books have largely been much more, not, much less about people being their best than about the mistakes that people who are trying to do their best make. And like, that people doing their best are, even as they do whatever they consider the best for themselves, for their family, for their friends, for their house, are constantly, like, it's how Jon Snow dies, by doing the best, by doing the right thing.
I agree with you.
Like, it's the idea that, like, merely doing the best is flawed in and of itself, because we can't escape our own flaws. It doesn't let us, like, no one in the series just gets to rise above that.
Well, I mean, I agree with you, Glazer, but there comes a point where you have to choose between, like, I mean, one of the things is, like, you have to choose between, like, life and other things, other choices. Like, there's a point where you have to pick, like, you can put in, like, whether you're going to acquiesce to Spain being taken over by the fascists, or you're going to resist, like, to put in actual historical context. And, like, that's an existential crisis that is informed massively by the kind of person you are and your own personal struggles and the choices you're going to be. But there comes a point where all of those things put you in that – society puts that person you are in that position. The world puts yourself in that position. You have to make a choice. And
absolutely,
that's the story I'm interested in. And that's where I think the struggle for the White Walkers comes from.
Me too.
But the story Thrones tells isn't – like, the story Thrones tells starts with that, but it says whatever choice you make, even when you choose to fight for life, you will still be flawed. You will still you will still have feet of clay. And, like, even when you do choose to fight on the side of life, it forces you to sacrifice things. It forces you to sacrifice parts of yourself and parts
Glazer,
of
X, Y, and Z. We're all agreeing here. We're
good thing there were
I think the fundamental thing we're agreeing here. But
it's a series. It doesn't have to be an episode individually.
Like, we're agreeing here, Aaron. Okay. I guess the point you could say is, what is the context in which those kind of choices at the end of the day, that the note you want to end your series on, is it a note about the kind of big picture, choose life, choose hope over fat, whatever you want to say, thing that you could say that the struggle against the others, the White Walkers, like, is that the note you want to end on? Or is it the note and the ways in which, even when you make that right decision, you're still a creature of, you're still human, you still have a foot of clay, you're going to make mistakes, bad things are going to happen because of the choices that you made, even if they were made in service of amazing, of important life-saving things? Or is it, like, who ends up on the Iron Throne? Like, which final context is the most interesting and most narrative and pleasing? I think it's the former. You think it's the latter, and the showrunners agree with you, which is fine, but I it makes me sad. Like, I'm not as much as Jesse, but it makes me sad because something I cared about ended up not being exactly the kind of story that I wanted to invest myself so fully in. Like, that's
fair. It's just, I think that you thought you were reading a comedy and I thought I was reading a tragedy is ultimately what this comes down to. I still think I'm ultimately reading a tragedy where even if the heroes win, they're going to have to sacrifice so much at the end. My current, if they have the guts to do it.
Why do they?
Because they're writing a tragedy.
I mean, just in the context of the show, if we're looking at that, like, there's no need to sacrifice anything at this point. Like, they made out of this battle.
That is literally.
Isn't it literally like if they defeated Sauron in book three, like, Saruman is just like raising like an army of Uruk-hai to like rule Middle Earth. Like, no one gives a shit. Like, you already beat the final boss. Like, no one cares.
That's not the story you were reading. So the
structure. Yes, it was the story. You just disagree.
No, like.
Yes, you're not right about everything in the world.
I'm not. I mean, this is literally just narrative structures. I mean, no, in a comedy, like. In a comedy, the way you're trying to read it, let me actually explain this. This is literally my job. Let me actually try and explain this. Because in a comedy, right before the end, like, and they could just blow this off because TV and Hollywood and happy endings, but I'm assuming they're not.
Because D&D or dog shit.
Well, okay. Because in a comedy, very specifically, the point of Lois, the point where it looks like no one is going to win, would be right before the end. It would look like there's no hope. They would have to make horrible, terrible sacrifices, and then they would win, and everything would just be great. It would end, Dany and John would get married, and it would be the end. They would have eliminated Cersei before this even happened. In a tragedy, everything has to look like it's going to work out for the best, and the heroes are going to win. The reason it's tragic is but for one last twist, things were going to work out. Everything hits that high note, which is what you just watched. What you just watched was that high note. That's why there wasn't that level of support. Should be, assuming that we're following classic plot structure, why we're dealing with this. Because what we're dealing with is the moment in the tragedy where it looks like everything's going to work out for the best. And that's a very different story. What D&D did not do is set up that they were telling a tragedy at all. They set it up so that it looked like a comedy. Maybe that's brilliant, maybe that's terrible, but like, it looked, and what you're functionally arguing for is a classical comedy. And I think what they're telling you is a classical tragedy. Like, my current best guess for the ending is something like another Red Wedding for Dany and John.
I don't think it will go that far.
Not necessarily that far, but something genuinely negative has to happen to end this.
Oh, a lot of negative things are going to happen in the fight.
I'm sure anything that I've like hoped and dreamed for 8 years like won't happen, and they'll just ruin the characters I love.
I mean, I agree with you. You're
still not understanding, but it's fine.
No, Glazer, I agree with you.
I don't have to understand. It's either I like a story and I want something to happen, or I don't. I don't have to understand how you want me to, and then play it out a certain way. Like, I don't care.
That's not what I'm arguing at all. All right, whatever.
Yes, it is. You're like, you still don't understand. I get it. I understand what narrative structure means. I'm not an idiot.
But like, okay.
Yeah, like, I don't care. I wanted it to go a certain way. It didn't. Like, I'm still happy that people are enjoying it. It's just not something I enjoy.
Okay. It has literally nothing to do with my point, but that's fine.
Well, then I don't care about your point.
I'm afraid we are probably wandering into the danger zone here. I feel like we're just going to keep rolling down this topic for another hour if we let it go. I'll happily continue this like in the chat afterward. Okay. In that case, I'll just awkwardly close this chapter of the White Book. I expect at least some kind of commiseration that this was
you said danger
dangerously
zone,
close to the danger zone.
Yeah, I thought we were done.